Heavenly King, Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, present everywhere and filling all things, the treasury of good and giver of life, come and dwell in us and cleanse us from every impurity and save our souls, gracious one. Before Michael makes his presentation, I'd like to basically introduce him with a few more details than you already know. The first thing you need to know is yesterday he ran in the Melbourne Marathon, and I remarked to him when he arrived today, you don't look like you've just run a marathon. So either he hides it really well or he's going to fall apart halfway through the talk, one of the two. So Michael Zervos is a third generation Greek Australian with his grandfather Michael Mangos. We've met a lot of Mangoses here in Australia over the years. And his grandfather Michael Mangos arrived here in 1908. Michael attributes the ethnic experience of being raised in the back of the fish and chip shop in Richmond as formative to his work ethic and career development. Michael has been with the Alana and Madeline Foundation as General Manager Operations since February 2006. In this time, the charity has grown into a national organization, employing close to 50 staff and hundreds of volunteers. He has worked in senior roles with a number of organizations, including Melbourne Water, CPA Australia, Orica, Cadbury and Repco. Before the Alana and Madeline Foundation, Michael was responsible for the finance, information systems, human resources and administration functions with the national children's charity Make-A-Wish Foundation. He contributed to Make-A-Wish's complete reorganization, resulting in a doubling in revenue to over $12 million, which is astounding for a charity of that kind. Some career highlights include a stint in East Africa, on assignment for Cadbury Schweppes, relocating to Los Angeles for a year whilst working for Repco and project work on the disaggregation of Melbourne Water. Married to Rosalind, the couple have two children, 21-year-old Cassie and 17-year-old Marcus. Michael enjoys spending time with his family, especially days at the beach, and recently the family retraced their heritage with a trip to the island of Castellorizo. Being a dad, Michael was drawn to the children's charity sector philosophy and mission of supporting children. Not one to shy away from a physical challenge, he climbed Mount Kilimanjaro in Africa as part of a charity fundraiser in 2005. The topic tonight of hope after tragedy resonates with Michael given his charity work. He will discuss the good that can result from seemingly hopeless situations. Michael, welcome again, and it's all yours.
Thank you, Father. After that wonderful introduction, particularly about the marathon, I wasn't sure if I was able to get up out of the chair. So thank you for having me here tonight. And my intention tonight is in a formal way to chat with you, but also to relay that in a sense a little bit about who I am, and as Father said, a little bit about my experience in the not-for-profit sector. And I won't talk for too long, I hope, because I am an accountant by training, so by definition I'm a little bit boring, so you'll have to put up with that. So I'd rather share some thoughts with you in the slides and then have a chance to interact with you, and I encourage you to ask me any questions that I can, anything you feel like, I'll certainly be happy to answer them for you. And I'll start by a little bit of a repeat of what Father has shared with you, that a little bit about my professional bio. I'm a Bachelor of Economics, I'm a certified practicing accountant, and I'm a graduate from the Australian Institute of Company Directors. I've done a course at the Manalyzer Executive Education, Harvard Business School. I only put that piece of shelf a little bit. It was only for 1 week, but gee, it was a wonderful experience. And it was talking about the not-for-profit sector, and in particular, how do you measure how well a charity is actually going? Now, I am going to talk quite in a business mind today, but with intent of telling you about what the charity is about and why we do exist. I've done a course in ethical leadership, which is fantastic, at Cranlana, which is wonderful. Spent some time in Africa, which was an amazing experience. Los Angeles was an amazing experience as well in the 80s. It was an incredible place to be. Father has told you that I've spent some time in the water industry, I project manage the introduction of GST for the accounting body, which is CPA Australia, and that's as boring as it can get, I can assure you. What I'm particularly excited about is the last two dots points on that slide, and that is having spent some time at the Make-A-Wish Foundation, and I'm currently at the Alana and Madeline Foundation. And I must say that we're neighbours. The Alana and Madeline Foundation is actually based here in Clarendon Street, across the road. If you know where the National Australia Bank is and where there's a fish and chip shop, which is near and dear to my heart, hunky-dory, right there, right on top of that, is the actual head office of the Alana and Madeline Foundation. But as importantly as all that, as Father said, I was brought up in the back of a fish and chip shop in Richmond. And I must say, I'm dressed as a businessman, I am an accountant, but I learn as much about how commerce and how business works is from my dad in the shop. And that was a wonderful experience. I'm not sure if, you know, it's pretty traditional for someone of Greek background to be brought up in a fish and chip shop. And so that was a magnificent experience, as well as my parents. My whole heritage is from the island of Gustaludazor, the Kazis. I'm not sure if anybody know any Kazis or, yeah, we've been around for a long time. And Bapu Mukali was here in 1908. And there's even people in the audience who knew my Bapu, and I'm proudly named after him. And so we have a tradition of being involved in fish and chip shops. I'm married to my wife, Roslyn, who is also a Kazi, and her family actually had a fruit shop. So in many ways, that's pure breeding. If I've got the fish and chip shop and Roz has got the fruit shop, that's pretty good for Greeks. So, and we've been out here a long, long time, and to have that sort of background, we're quite proud of. And I'm also proud of the fact that we've been married for 29 years, and next year we celebrate our 30th anniversary. I'm not sure what we're going to do about that, but the pressure is on me. And if someone can tell me what the 30th year is, you know how they're diamond and gold and things like that, please let me know. And I have two wonderful children, Cassandra and Marcus. And yes, I did climb Mount Kilimanjaro in Africa for Climbing for Wishes. It was a charity climb for the Make-A-Wish Foundation, an amazing experience. And again, happy to talk about anything that I'll never do it again, but it was right outside my comfort zone. And I'd never been camping before, but it was an amazing experience if anyone has an opportunity. And you'll see that I've got completed 10 marathons. And notice what happens after that. There's a bracket that says, hopefully. The reason for that is because I wrote this slide before the marathon yesterday and I had no idea how I was going to go. So if I'm a little vague at times, if I start to fade a little bit, please bear with me, because the marathon and the why I've done the marathons is because it goes back to my Greek heritage, and the town of Marathon is where it all began, 40 kilometres outside Athens. And so, in fact, Roz and I did the marathon yesterday. And in 2010, we went back to Greece and we retraced the steps of Pheidippides and we ran the original course, which was an amazing experience. So I'm going to stand up here. I'm going to stand very straight, because if I sit down again, I don't think I'll be able to get up because the legs are pretty sore. I make the point I'm not a theologian. I have a strong faith. But tonight I want to talk to you more from my experiences, more from my business background. And I don't mean any offence by that, but I want to take you inside what a charity can look like. Because every one of us would have experienced donating to a charity or being involved in some shape and form. But I thought you might find it insightful if I actually share how do we go about building a charity, how do we go about what does a particular charity do. So I'll take you inside the Alana and Madeline Foundation in particular. And then I'll actually talk quite businesslike about how we went about building it. Remembering the end result is what we're about, and I'll talk to you about that in a lot more detail. But given the sort of topic we've got, I'll start with a sad tale. And I'll read this out. During a long night time stakeout, kneeling in some desert weeds in the spring of 1980, US Customs agent Tommy Austin tells Arizona Department of Public Safety officer Ron Cox his problem. His wife's friend Linda has a small 7-year-old son named Chris Gracious, who's probably going to die of leukemia. Chris died of leukemia on the 3rd of May 1980, and that's a photo of Chris Gracious. I'm starting with a sad tale, because Chris and his family went through that tragedy, and his mother, Linda, of that tragic situation. And you can only just begin to imagine the sort of things and the sort of questions they're asking themselves. But importantly, you'll notice that how Chris is dressed, because that young fellow and the people who were talking about that experience recognised that Chris had a particular dream and wish, and that he wanted to be a state trooper. And so they thought what they would do is to honour him, honour his short life, they would actually induct him into the state troopers in America. And he actually, his uniform that he's wearing there, he became a state trooper. So they actually fulfilled his wish. And so as a young 7-year-old boy in 1980, he was actually buried in that uniform. Now, I never met his mother, Linda, but I certainly had a lot to do with that organisation, because as a result of her loss and the loss of that life, the Make-A-Wish Foundation was created. I presume everyone's heard of the Make-A-Wish Foundation. It is a global organisation. It's in 49 countries around the world. It's granted over 226,000 wishes in the USA. And in Australia, and I've been intimately involved with that organisation, it's granted over 7,000 wishes in Australia alone. So out of the tragedy of that one family came an organisation that is global and is helping children all over the place. And I've been involved and actually met families that have had wishes fulfilled, and it's a wonderful experience. They would never have heard of Chris Gracious. They don't know his mother, Linda. But they're the sort of things that can happen and come. And I want to also show you this photo. This photo is of Walter Mikak, and that's his daughter Alana, who's 6, and Madeline, who's 3. And these are the two little girls, along with 32 other people that lost their lives with their mother at the Port Arthur tragedy. So this man, a family man, on a trip down to Tasmania, lost his entire family. The foundation was established in the memory of the Alana and Madeline Mikak, 6 and 3, with their mother Nanette, and 32 others were killed at Port Arthur, Tasmania, on the 28th of April 1996. Again, a sad tale, and I wasn't around and hadn't met Walter at that point in time. I've obviously had a lot to do with him since, but can you imagine the sort of questions he was asking himself? And Walter was quoted soon after losing his family. The idea of the foundation came from another Melbourne father who, just like me, had 2 daughters. He'd been looking at their drawings on the fridge when he thought of the idea of setting up a foundation to help ease the suffering of all these children. To me, this illustrates how an ordinary person can make a difference, and it is an ability that is in every one of us. That was the dad who lost his wife and children saying that. So 16 years later, I've started with some very sad tales, but what my intention is for the rest of the evening is to talk about what's happened in the next 16 years since that awful tragedy in Tasmania. I want to talk in quite detail, take you inside the Alana and Madeline Foundation, what we do, but also how do we create what I've said there is our hope. And again, I will talk from the business point of view, but clearly all through this will be the intention of helping children. So we're going to take you on that journey and share, because you will be involved in organisations, whether they're commercial or charities or the church, and you want to actually achieve something. So as I'm talking about my experiences within this organisation, just have a think about if any of this applies to your own case. And happy to take questions and the like, because I've been involved in both the Make-A-Wish Foundation and for a longer period of time in building the Alana and Madeline Foundation over recent years. So the foundation starts with a vision, a mission and values. Very corporate stuff, but in our case it means a lot, because our mission is keeping children safe from violence. All the big corporates have these sorts of things, but in our case it's about keeping children safe from violence. And that's our mission. Our vision is, the foundation's vision is, that every child will live in a safe and supportive environment. And it's wonderful to be part of an organisation, and it is my job to be involved in an organisation that the whole reason it exists is to keep children safe from violence. It's wonderful to be part of that, but we have to turn that into reality. And it's no accident that I put there our values, because an organisation has to come up with, what does it really stand for? What are those values? And you can read them there. Caring, friendliness, valuing difference, including others, respect and responsibility. And one thing I remind myself all the time, and I remind anyone I get a chance to talk to, is if you're going to talk about what the values of your organisation are, make sure you don't just do it once and put it in a drawer or put it in the back cupboard. Make sure you talk about it all the time. We have it plastered all over the walls at times and the like, and we're particularly proud of valuing difference. When we first put that down, we actually put accepting difference. Whether it's more than that, we want to actually value the contribution different type of people bring to us. Showing off a little bit here, but we have a founding patron in Walter Mikak, the father of Alana and Madeline. We're lucky enough to have the Prime Minister of the day as our national patron, and that came about because in 1996, when Port Arthur took place, John Howard had been recently appointed as Prime Minister. And you may remember, those who are old enough to remember, there was a lot of talk and a lot of about gun control in our country. And as a result of that awful tragedy in Tasmania, there was major changes to the gun controls in Australia. And in fact, America, through its recent experience, has been talking to Australia quite a lot about what we've done in that area. So we're lucky enough to have the Prime Minister of the day. It's hard to keep a photo up to date with the Prime Minister of the day in recent times, so that's a slightly older photo. We also have Her Royal Highness Crown Princess Mary of Denmark as our international patron. The reason for that, she's a Tasmanian girl. And yes, I've met the princess a couple of times, and yes, I forgot to bow when I was supposed to. I completely forgot to do that, so I completely mucked that up. But I am proud to say I've met a princess. Not bad for a humble accountant from a fish and chip shop. Proud of that one. And we do have ambassadors. Aaron Blaby, he's a children's author. And Robert, and I'll call him Dipper because I can never pronounce his surname, but he's an ex-Hawthorn footballer. A lot of people know about Dipper, and he's a wonderful larger-than-life character that helps us out wherever he can. So let me tell you about our programs. Let me start with buddy bags. Around Australia tonight, there'll be children who have to be removed from a dangerous situation, most of it domestic violence. And often it'll be with their mum, and often it'll be just with the clothing on their back. And they'll be taken to a refuge. And that child, I can't begin to imagine what that child and the mum are going through. But what we've organised through the foundation is to have a thing called a buddy bag. And it's a backpack containing essential items of children's emergency accommodation. It's got things in it like pyjamas and a toothbrush and a teddy bear and the like. So that child has been through that horrible experience. The carer in that refuge will give that child a backpack. And it won't be that it won't say you're the welfare child, you're a lower class citizen. It's brand new, it's theirs to keep, and it's an act of kindness, an act of love, and it creates a bond between the carer and that child and that family. And you'll see there that the child can, if they want to, also return a postcard just to say a quick thank you. So this year we will distribute 9,000 bags across the country. So far we've distributed 38,000. Completely for free. We organise to generate the funding from elsewhere so we can provide this to the children. So we're in hundreds and hundreds of refuges all over Australia at the moment. So that's just one thing we recognise, is if we can do something to help that child that's going through something tonight and tomorrow. We hope one day we'll have to distribute zero, but we're practical and we have to recognise the reality of what's happening today in our society. Imagine that child a little bit further along the path. They're not in physical danger anymore. But once they're established, maybe they're living with mum or maybe a carer or a grandparent, how do you then help that child recover from the serious violence and trauma? So we have a Children Ahead program. We actually engage social workers that will work with that child, their siblings and their family, and to help that child and build that resilience going forward. So we help about 50 families at the moment, and it's a very intense program. We work with that family for years and years. We also have a program called a Refuge Therapeutic Support Program. This is where we actually grant funds to other organisations. Again, that same child, that they've had the trauma, they're now getting some help from our social workers, but they may have a particular interest. It may be music, it may be art and the like. So we fund art, music and pet therapy along the way. So we're trying to generate funds so we can help others who are helping the children out there across our country. But then we've recognised there's a major form of violence in our society, bullying and cyber safety. And there's a lot more publicity and a lot more talk about this topic all the time. Now, there's a lot of it. The statistics tell us this, 1 in 4 children are bullied every 2 weeks or more often. And 1 in 10 children are cyber bullied every week. That's a lot of our kiddies. Australian families are concerned about the cyber safety, sexting, privacy issues, unwanted contact by strangers. And the impact of bullying and cyberbullying can be a devastating effect on children. And we've done a lot to promote the conversation about this awful topic in our society. It's not fun to talk about. It's not a nice topic. And it's not a pleasant topic. But unless we talk about it, we can't take any steps towards fixing it. So there's a lot of... We're seeing a lot more publicity about it, a lot more dialogue about it. And that's a good thing, because the more we talk about it as a society, the more we can do something about it. Bullying is the most common form of violence, abuse children and young people are faced within their lives. 27% of young children report bullied every 2 weeks, as I said. And that shot of a child being isolated in a schoolyard. And when I usually talk to people about where I work, the amount of times that people tell me about, and this is people of my age who've been out of school for many a year, but they recount and remember vividly the experience, their own schoolyard experiences. And this might be a familiar shot. An older child bullying a younger child. You might remember this. I show this for two reasons. One is to show you a picture of schoolyard bullying, but also to give you an insight, because my talk is about business tonight, but also it's about me, is to say that the little boy being bullied there, he's a paid actor. But that horrible bully is actually my son, Marcus. Okay, so when you work in a not-for-profit sector, your family is fair game. They come in and help you anywhere they can. And when we recruit people, we not only see if they've got the right skills, we also, do you have a brother-in-law with a ute? You got anybody who knows people? So my son, Marcus, is teased quite a lot by us, jokingly about being the bully. He's certainly not a bully. He's a beautiful young, and now he's 6'2" and a 17-year-old, lovely, strapping young lad. But he didn't like doing that, but he's a good little actor, and he was doing acting classes at the time, so we thought it'd be a good experience. And that's partly me being the talk tonight, partly me showing off as a dad because I like showing a photo of my son. That's the only way I could think about getting it in tonight. Let me move on to another program, a Better Buddies framework. And for those who work in the primary school, it's Better Buddies helps students entering their first year of primary school to feel safe, valued and connected to the school community. The school pairs new primary students with their older buddy. Imagine a prep student coming in, there's people nodding in the audience, a prep student coming into a school, they are buddied up with an older child. Now, most schools will have some form of buddying system. What we've done is actually developed a program. We used RMIT University to help us develop it. And we have a big purple bear, Buddy Bear. And what we're really doing at the very earliest point that we can get children within the school system is engage them in understanding, first of all, the younger children are able to have a buddy that they can interact with, but the older children are learning respect, they're learning responsibility. And so the older children are able to be engaged. And what we're looking to do, and it's no coincidence, what we're looking to do is create at the very youngest level where our children are all together in the school community, is have them engage with each other and create an environment where they're buddies, not bullies. So we don't call it an anti-bullying program. We're trying to create a positive, reinforcing environment for the children. And so Better Buddies are very much an important part, and it is no coincidence that it starts at the prep school and the primary school. So, we're in well over 1,000 schools across the country. And again, we get support financially, so we can give that to most schools whenever we can. So we're here to exist to try and actually help out the schools and give it to them if we can. But then over recent times, and I'm old enough to remember before a lot of technology, but the world is changing. And so our challenge was, how can we embrace the benefits of technology and at the same time protect our children and youth from cyberbullying and other risks online? And as a parent of teenagers, I hear this a lot. How do we do it? How do we go about it? How do we protect ourselves and the like? That's an awful shot of sexual predators online. It's a horrible modern environment we find ourselves in. The solution that the Alana Madeline Foundation has come up with is called eSmart. It's a world-leading online quality assurance and audit system. That all sounds very, very sort of dry and the like, but let me sort of turn it into our thinking for you. We recognise that technology exists. We recognise technology is part of our society and we'll go. We can't be naive enough to say it's not going to be there anymore. It is. And so what we did, being a fairly new organisation, we said, well, what other examples are there out there? And we found SunSmart and Quit. And if I can sort of refresh your memories a little bit about SunSmart, remember slip, slop, slap. Remember now if we go into a schoolyard, the kiddies have to wear hats. If we go down the beach, we put sunblock on, we put a cap on and the like. That organisation has changed our behaviour. They didn't come along and fine us if we're on the beach without a hat. They didn't come along and take us off the beach. In the same way, we can't hide from technology. We have to find a way of educating and the like. So we looked at models. We basically copied the thinking of saying, how can you change people's thinking? How can you educate people? And that's why SunSmart, we came up with eSmart. And how do we go about creating an eSmart Australia? Remember, our mission is keeping children safe from violence. The smart, safe, responsible. You'll see that anything to do with the Alana and Madeline Foundation eSmart. We talk about smart, embracing technology for the future. Again, recognising it exists. And who knows what the technology will be. Don't ask me about that. I'm not an expert in that field. You're better off asking Marcus, my 17-year-old son. He knows more about technology than I ever will. And the younger one, I can't believe when I see people with younger kiddies how much they're engaged and how they accept technology. I'm still scared of these computers and things like that. I still need help with it. But that's me being a bit of an old-fashioned dinosaur. Safe. Children and young people know how to keep... We want to help that the children and young people know how to keep themselves safe online. And parents know how to protect their children in the cyber world. And the responsible side is we as a society should be respectful, caring and friendly. And we want to create those sort of environments for ourselves. So we set ourselves pretty ambitious goals, but we don't shy away from that at all. And in a practical sense, how do we go about that? How do we make an e-smart Australia? How do we create a safe, smart, responsible environment? This involves all of us: parents, teachers, librarians, the police, employers, government, young people, everybody in this room. We all have a part to play in this. In a practical sense, how have we gone about it? We've gone about it through the school system. We've gone about it through the libraries. We've gone about it through the family home, a digital license, which I'll talk about in a moment, and also the most recent one that we're starting to work with is the workplace, because a lot of apprentices are going in, and I'll talk about something that's happened fairly recently in a moment with you. eSmart Schools is pretty much a one, I won't go through all the slide, but it's a one-stop shop for the school. Where do they turn for IT policies? Where do they turn to be able to navigate their way through what's happening out there? So we bring it together we've got researchers who are forever looking at what the latest ideas are and the like. So it's a wonderful place for a school to be able to walk their way through being cyber smart and e-smart and actually get accreditation at the end of it. And in the same way, libraries. We recognise that schools, libraries, I'm talking about the modern library as the learning centre. And this is another place where children are congregating and interacting. And often we're finding children that haven't got the money to engage in their technology themselves will find their way to the library. And we're rolling out the cyber safety program eSmart across libraries. And we're supported by the Telstra Foundation. And we're going to roll it across every single library, 1,500 in the next few years, for free to the libraries, because we've been able to organise that through a corporate. That's why I dress in a suit a lot, because I do a lot with corporates. The eSmart digital license is in development. You may know about children getting a pen license. You may sometimes you get a swim, you get a driver's license. So what we're developing is a concept where children can do a test online, a fun test, and they can learn about cyber safety. Let me give you an example of one of the questions we're coming up with. It's a question for a child about what is an appropriate image to put up in social media. Now, clearly a provocative shot of them in swimwear that's an obvious one. But what about in their school uniform? Most children would think, well, that's not too bad. I can put my school uniform. But a predator can identify what that school is and identify that child's geography. And what we want to do in a fun, funky sort of way for the kids, not by a person like me who's, you know, corporate and things like that, but something that children will engage with, help the children, and also give the parents something the child can do to be able to help that child understand and learn. Now, excitingly, eSmart Workplaces, it's in development, but we've recognised that apprenticeships can be a dangerous starting point for people, and there was recently a girl, Brodie Panlock, who worked in a cafe in Glenferrie Road, who took her own life as a direct result of workplace bullying, and as a result of that, Brodie's Law was created, and some of you may have heard of that. Well, I'm delighted to say that Damien and Ray Panlock, Brodie's parents, who had begun their own charity foundation in Brodie's memory to educate people, we've been dealing with them, and now they're actually now working with us at the Alana Madeline Foundation. So we've merged together, so we're one organisation being able to sort of pool our resources to be able to go forward, and we're developing now something for the workplaces, being a good boss in the workplace and the like. So we're very excited about that, and that's only happened in recent times. And another concept we're developing now is the eSmart Home, a mini cyber safety audit tool at home aimed at parents and carers. And, for example, in our home, where should the computer be? You know, is it okay for a teenager to have a computer in their bedroom at night? Is it okay for the teenager or child of any age to have 24/7 access to technology? And how do you interact with your children along those lines? So we're trying to help the families in that sense. So we're developing, and we'll have that up pretty quickly, eSmart Homes through a website and the like. And we get all this expertise through the National Centre Against Bullying. We have experts in this field who know about what the latest trends are, not just in Australia but around the world, who are contributing to our programs and the like. And so if we bring all that together, we have programs in care. Now, Buddy Bags, we've distributed 38,000 bags across the country. Children Ahead, we're helping 50 children right now. We're giving 10 grants across the country for refugee therapy. The number of schools we're helping is thousands and thousands of schools, and we're growing and the like. So we're helping in caring for children today, we're trying to prevent for tomorrow, and we're also advocating for a change in society. And there's a map of Australia showing we are all over the country in all our programs across the nation, which is fantastic. And also in Denmark, and we've gone into other countries as well. The technology is naturally jumping across boundaries and the like, so we're able to, we can't stop it going internationally, so we're quite excited about that. So I've run you through a little bit of commercial about what we do, but I wanted to take you inside the charity to give you a sense of what we physically do. And I was trying to give you an insight into the fact that we've thought about it quite a lot in terms of how do you? We want to keep children safe from violence, but what does that actually mean in practical terms? So it's no accident. We've got particular programs, and it's not, and it's by design that we're in particular places like schools and libraries and the like. So now, today, 16 years later, we've got close to 50 employees. We've got over 300 volunteers, which is gorgeous and wonderful. And we've got something like $10 million a year of activity going on, put towards our mission of keeping children safe from violence. Now, when Walter Mikek lost his family in 1996, he didn't foresee any of this happening. And frankly, none of us foresaw the extent of the size of the organisation. But this is sort of some of the hope that come out of it. So what I'm going to do now is run you through how we created that. And again, it will be quite corporate, but I make no apologies for that, because if you want to help children, we've got to have the resources to do it. First one we thought about was, why do we need to exist? Does another charity, I was talking to someone before we started, there are 60,000 charities in Australia, 60,000. Now, a lot of them duplicate what others are doing, and most of them are actually smaller in terms of their size than the local milk bar. Not saying that's a bad thing, but if size can give you more reach, can help more children, can achieve you what your objective is, maybe that helps. So we looked at, are we going to make a difference? Are we doing something different? And in fact, to give you another insight, a number of years ago we had a wonderful program called Children's Angels, and every year we would give something like 2,000 children Christmas presents, which is absolutely gorgeous, and it meant a lot to those children. But then we realised there are other organisations who have more resources, who can do it more efficiently, who can get to more children. So we actually transitioned those 2,000 children to other charities, so we could focus on the programs talked to you about today. So what we're trying to do is maximise the good that we can do in a practical sense. So are we making a difference? Are we? And one of our criteria for deciding should we do it is anyone else doing it? If someone else is doing it, can we help them do it better? And that, an example of that is how we joined with the Brodie's Law Foundation, because if we want to help in workplaces, they're doing work in that area, wouldn't it be wonderful if we can work together and have a bigger impact? And that's what we've done. The next question we asked ourselves, who would be involved? I've told you about our patrons. The board of directors. Now, again, this is corporate, I know, but the people who lead the organisation have to have the right skills to lead the organisation. And we're blessed with people who know what it means to be on a board of directors, know what it means to be thinking about today, but also thinking about tomorrow, and also thinking about what the organisation is about. The key staff and getting the right people who have the skills to be doing the right jobs. I've told you about my background today. I am not a cyber safety expert. I'm not a social worker. I'm not an educator. It would be inappropriate for me, with my skills, doesn't matter how enthusiastic I am, and I am very enthusiastic about our organisation, but I don't have the right technical skills, so we've got to get the right people. And when we couldn't afford it, we would ask everybody who would help us, until we found someone that would help us. As we got bigger, we were then able to get people part-time and the like. So key staff. And also we have a lot of part-time staff, including me. So with technology, the outside world doesn't know it, but I get paid less because I work less days. And we're very family friendly, so I think a third to half our workforce is actually part-time. It suits a lot of people, and we're able to attract very skilled, very passionate, very talented people to work with us. Volunteers, I can't talk long enough about volunteers. We would not exist without the beautiful goodwill and help of our volunteers. They're just spectacular. They're wonderful. We have people that help us once a year at our events, and we have people who come and help us every single week, and people who bring their expertise, their enthusiasm, just absolutely gorgeous and wonderful people. And broader supporters, and that can be everybody from major corporations who give us lots of money to right across the spectrum individuals. Now, to create some good that we wanted to, we actually had to make sure that we had to agree what we were looking to achieve, what was our mission. Now that sounds pretty obvious, keeping children safe from violence. But if I take you back to the Make-A-Wish Foundation, that's a gorgeous organisation that wants to grant cherished wishes to children who've got life-threatening illnesses. But what that actually means for that individual family can be quite different. Different people in an organisation can have different ideas about what the good should look like. And an example I use is, has anyone ever been involved in planning a major family event? It might be a wedding, a significant birthday. Everybody wants that to be the most gorgeous event they've ever had. But often there's tension along the way, because my idea of a gorgeous wedding might be different to someone else's. In the same case within our world, in the not-for-profits, in the charities, my idea about keeping children safe from violence might look different from someone else. So we as a group had to continually talk about, what does it mean? Should we be all over Australia? Should we just be Victoria? Should we just be one program? Should we this? Should we that? And there was times we had to say, we just cannot do that because we just haven't got enough resources, we haven't got enough people, we haven't got enough anything, we haven't got enough energy to do that. Let's focus and concentrate. So it's important to get a sense of what the organisation is about and what, in our case, what keeping children safe from violence looked like. That was an important one to do. Now I'm going to talk about that horrible topic of money, revenue. I have to talk about it because, to be practical, we need the funds to be able to fulfil our mission to help the children. This is all about helping the children. And I've got the word revenue strategy, very corporate speak, and that was me doing that, unashamedly so, because what we had to make sure is we didn't have all our eggs in one basket. You might have heard that saying, which means we didn't have all our money coming from one place. Everyone's heard of the global financial crisis that has affected the country over the last number of years, and that affected a lot of not-for-profits because a lot of people, they were reliant on money coming from certain places, and that money just wasn't available anymore. This isn't about the money, it's about what you're looking to achieve, in our case, helping the children. So what we did was have a revenue strategy, and it's no accident that we have support from governments, we have support from corporations, we have support from the public. We run events, so we have about 6 or 7 different ways that funding can come in, just in case. And luckily we did, because just in case a few years ago, the people who were from businesses couldn't support us as much because they were doing it tough. The trusts and foundations that distribute funds didn't have as much to distribute anymore. So we wanted to make sure we protected ourselves from that. So it was a business-minded way to go about it, but remember, why? To fulfil our mission of keeping children safe from violence. And as importantly, how we spend our money. Expenditure controls, just like any other business, and we get audited and we make sure that we get as much, I've got the word pro bono, or value in kind support. You know, we've got lawyers that help us for free. We've got accountants that help us for free. The National Australia Bank is kind enough to support us, and that's why we're able to be in Clarendon Street. We're able to get as much support as we can by asking, and we ask all the time to different organisations about supporting us and helping us. And we're very, very respectful in doing that, because it's not just a matter of going, give us money, give us money. We really need to explain what our organisation is about. We need to explain what we're going to do with that money. We need to tell people what we do with that money and explain to them where it's going to go. We need to be able to work with those organisations about how they can help, because some organisations will help you with money, some organisations will help you with their expertise, like our lawyers and our accountants, and some organisations will help you with their workforce by volunteering. So we look to interact with organisations and people as much as we can to keep our costs as low as we can. And as I said to you, we keep our salaries a bit lower because a lot of us are part-time. So, and that's a great way of being able to keep our salaries a bit lower, but also have wonderful people work with us. It gives them a bit of lifestyle as well. So work-life balance is really very real in our world. And what type of organisation do we want to be? Our culture, our values. If anyone would like to come and visit the Alana and Madeline Foundation, feel free through Father Chris to organise it. We're literally just across the road. And if you come and have a look at us, we're a children's charity. And yes, I'm dressed like a business guy today, and I always do. But if you come and have a look at what we look like, you'll actually see that we're quite bright and colourful, because we are a children's charity. We do have kiddies come and visit us from time to time. And yes, we have to make sure our health and safety and all that is there, and it's an efficient workplace, and there's enough meeting rooms and desks for everybody and all that. But we have a yellow brick road. We have a picnic area which actually has fake grass inside. We have a cubby house room where the kiddies come in, and it's not a meeting room like a boardroom. We have a boardroom somewhere else for all the business meetings. But our culture is represented in our physical environment. Our culture is represented in how we employ our staff by having a lot of part-time staff. And our culture and our values are lived all the time. We're forever looking for ways. And as part of our staff get-together, we'll talk about, well, how can we demonstrate that we care? How can we demonstrate that we're friendly? How can we demonstrate respect? So we're always asking each other how we do that. And it's something we always have to do because it's so easy to get involved in the day-to-day, the busy, I've got that piece of work to do, that to do, and forget about the important things about what the organisation really exists for. And I've got there, how are we sustainable? Strategy and financial planning. Again, what I'm talking about there is we want to help children. How can we help children today, and how can we make sure we're building an organisation that can help children tomorrow? So in many ways we have to think about the resources we have today, and we have put money away for a rainy day, just in case. And so that's us thinking about today and also thinking about tomorrow. So we think about this a lot. We think about, we want to help children. There's going to be children we need to help today, tomorrow and the future. So how do we do that? How do we continue to think like that? So there's times when we've had some money and we thought, we won't spend it. So even though the temptation was to help children this year, we might say, no, we'll keep some of that aside for next year, because just in case. And that also starts to build a bit of a nest egg. So if something did go wrong financially, it wouldn't mean that we'd have to stop. Because the saddest thing that would happen would be if we didn't have enough people, resources, we'd actually stop helping children. And that would be, that's unthinkable in our world. So, we need the resources to be able to do it. And how do we know we're successful? Well, we actually get others to tell us that. We actually get organisations to come in and evaluate our programs. And most of that's by survey, because culture change is difficult to measure. But we're very mindful of making sure we continue to have people double check what we're doing. Are we doing the right thing? Are we helping in the right way? So we tend to get universities to help us do that. So it's not just us thinking, is that the right way to do it? Are the programs having the impact they're supposed to have? So a lot of that is quite business-like. And I make no apologies for that, because they're the steps for success to ultimately, in our case, not just make more money for profits for shareholders, but it's also to create enough resources just as a means of being able to achieve what we want to do. And that's be able to give programs to schools, to give programs to libraries, to be able to impact, if people cannot afford things, that shouldn't stop them having access to the knowledge and the technology that we want to avail ourselves of. So we think like this, which I keep repeating is quite business-like, but very clearly keeping in mind of keeping children safe from violence. And I don't want to talk for too much longer, but I want to put that photo there as much for me as anything else, because I remind you that's Walter Mikak and that's his daughter Alana and Madeline who lost their lives at Port Arthur. To remind myself, because I'm taking you through all the corporate stuff, and to remind myself that was a dad who, frankly, was off playing golf, and his wife and children went to Port Arthur just to have a look around, and his life was changed forever. And I can't begin to imagine the sort of questions he asked himself and his family asked him. Why? Why? Why do these bad things happen? Just to finish off, and then I'm happy to take any questions you like, I can't answer that question, why do bad things happen to good people? And that's a question that's asked all the time. What I do know is, though, that from a personal point of view, I'll never be given more than I can handle. Whatever I'm given, I'll be able to handle that. Destiny. Our destiny is in God's hands. So I unashamedly accept that. Tragedies happen. I don't know where the good will come from it. Walter didn't know that I'd be standing here talking to you. He never heard of me when all that happened. The children that I've talked about today, the schools, the libraries, the families, would never have heard of Walter Mikak and the like, the good that's come out of it. I know from my point of view, even though I have a strong corporate background, I've talked about that extensively through my conversation with you tonight, by being able to look at a photo like that and meet a person like that and deal and mix with families like this, it's made me a more sensitive person. It's made me a more sensitive husband and father, I hope and think. It's certainly made me less materialistic. It's certainly made me appreciate what I do have and the blessings I do have. And it's made me appreciate every day, every single day. And with that, I'd like to say I've really appreciated today, appreciated tonight. I've appreciated the opportunity to share with you. And I'd like to say thank you to Father Chris, because he's very wise, and I value his knowledge and his insight enormously from my family's point of view and for me as an individual's point of view. So I want to give thanks to that tonight, and also to say that I've just talked to you about the practical hope that's come out of a number of tragedies. And I'd invite you to, I'm finished with my presentation. I'm conscious of the type of person I am. I don't want to talk for too long. I like to interact more. So I'm happy to answer any questions you'd like about myself, the foundation, anything I can share with you. So I'll now open the floor to questions. And I think there might be a microphone that if anyone would like to ask me anything, please don't be shy. I remind you of my background. I am no theologian, so I'll leave that to others more qualified to give that insight. But I'm certainly happy to take any questions from the floor. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you for your presentation. I found that very insightful. I was just curious in relation to how you partner with Telstra, Target, the NAB to provide funding for you to keep your foundation going.
Yep. It's a great question. The question's around how do you partner? Well, the most important thing is to try and get a sense of why would that organisation want to partner with us? First of all, there's lots of good causes. Second of all, they're organisations that are commercial organisations. So what we try and do is it's all about relationship. We try and demonstrate some of the things I've demonstrated to them, that we try and get a sense of what their interest is. Some people have an interest in technology, some have an interest in schools, some homes. In Telstra's case, they were very excited about being able to be the one organisation that helped and partnered with us to roll out eSmart libraries across every one of the 1,500 public libraries across Australia. So it's a 3 or 4 year relationship over a period of time, and so it is a true partnership. We meet with them all the time about how many libraries we're going into. It takes a long time to interact, so we were probably talking to them for probably 2 or 3 years before they actually came on board. They needed to get a sense. We had to earn their respect and their credibility. We had to invite them to a number of other activities they were doing to see that, yes, we were people of our word, and we would be good custodians of the funding, because they want to get the maximum impact in society as well. So a lot of the things I talked about resonated with them about our controls and what we're about and how we would feedback measures to them. I guess an overarching thing was that we were respectful. It was a long-term interaction, a long-term relationship, and it will be a long-term relationship. It's not just a matter of going along saying, give us some money, oh, you're not interested, and not talk to them again. So it's very much about respect. There's lots of organisations who we're talking to and have talked to for a long time who haven't contributed to us, but we're still having dialogue with them because you never know what the future is. So I hope that gives you some insight.
For so many of us here in the room, we remember pretty vividly the Port Arthur event. And this foundation seems based on people's living memory of that horrible day. Do you envisage a time in the future where people will say, "What Port Arthur? Mm-hmm. I've never heard of that.
Sure.
Who are these girls?"
Yeah, indeed. It's a very good question, because Port Arthur was a long time ago, and there are lots of people who don't know about Port Arthur. But the issues that we're talking about, and we've evolved as an organisation, because where the organisation I joined even 8 years ago is quite different now. The technology side didn't exist. The topic of bullying is not directly linked in terms of the tragic events of Port Arthur, but it's a real issue in terms of society. The cyber safety and wellbeing are real issues in society. So you're right, we will never forget the memory of the girls and the image and the story of someone who lost their wife and children. That's a sad tale that will cross generations. The logo we use, and it's up on the screen right now, is that little drawing of two little girls, and if you look closely, it says me and sister. Alana drew that. Now, we continue to tell the story. We don't have a direct, strong link to Port Arthur as such. We never mention the perpetrator of the crime. We don't go there. So it's about the issues. It's about the issue of violence in our society, and as we've evolved and trying to keep up with society, that has evolved into the technology area, cyber safety and wellbeing. Did not even exist as an issue or even language a decade ago. And I don't know what it will be in the future, but it all comes back to the mission of keeping children safe from violence. And our job is to continue to to communicate to the society about the, you know, some of the bad things that are happening out there. It's not populist to be able to talk about violence, but we want to, in a respectful way, make sure society is dealing, is talking about this issue, because then they can start to do something about it. So you're right, it is something that the memory of the girls will be, for some of us will resonate quite a lot. For others who have never heard of it, we've got people who are involved with us now who have never heard of Port Arthur. And that's, but if you think about some of the main charities, they go back generations, but the spirit and the mission is still alive and well, and we would take the same view. Good question, thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for that. My question's a little bit twofold. Are you mainly doing work providing the communication and education to society per se and to schools, or can anyone refer to your organisation? For example, people who, vulnerable women and children in emergency departments in hospitals. I'm just thinking of the Dandenong area that I work mm-hmm. in as mm-hmm. a social worker. The churches around Dandenong, for example, provide kits or soap, toothpaste for women who go into refuges, and the children don't have much at all, so it's just myself trying to gather around, you know, things for the children. I didn't know about the buddy packs, mm-hmm. for example. Mm-hmm. Can I access those buddy packs or fellow social workers throughout hospitals in Victoria? Or do we have to, like, how does that work?
Yeah, it's, what we're looking to do is get the buddy bags to children who are vulnerable. And we mostly do that. We have an actual manager in that area, like I talked about before, who is the expert in that field. But our intent is to get it through as many sources as we can. Refuges, foster care and the like. And it sounds like you're linked with organisations that are helping children, so I can't see why we wouldn't be able to support you. So I'd encourage you to, I'll give you my card afterwards. Our intent is to help as many kids as we can, and if we can find a way, we'll do it. So depending where the organisation, I mean, or it doesn't matter where the geographically the organisation is, but in terms of where the physical housing of the bags would be, that's why we exist, and that's why I talked about all those other ways of being able to get resources so we can support. If there's a child out there in need, we'll try and help, and that's why we exist. So if I can help you, we will.
Thank you.
Sorry, I don't know if I missed it or not, but has the foundation addressed domestic violence?
Sorry, say that
domestic
again.
Violence?
Domestic violence.
Yeah, has it addressed or considered helping people in that situation?
Yeah, the question was about domestic violence, and what we've recognised is there are other organisations who have been working in that area. Because of our heritage and history of coming about from the children's point of view, a lot of what we're doing and buddy bags that we just talked about is a result of domestic violence and the like. So we're approaching it from, remember, a children's charity in that sense, and so we're approaching it from the point of view of the child and the buddy bag and the like. Where we can, we interact with other organisations, but we're very mindful of if there's other organisations who are doing work in that space, of not duplicating what they're doing. And that's why we identified buddy bags as an area that was a gap because there wasn't anything for the children and the like. So, and that's an example where it's very difficult some because there's so many issues out there in society, but we can't be all things to all people. So we say, what can we be good at? What's a natural progression for us in terms of from the children's point of view? And the reality is when we've got caseworkers who are dealing with children, a lot of it is domestic violence. And so our caseworkers, we thought, oh, we'll go in and be able to help that child. But you can't help that child unless you address the issues of the siblings. You can't help that child unless you address the issues of the family generally. So we end up helping out in that area because we have to, but very much through the lens of who we are in the organisation. It's very hard sometimes to not try and be all things to all people, but we're conscious of doing it through the existing programs like that, but we're very mindful of a lot of the work we do interacts with other organisations accordingly. Thank you.
Hi, thank you very much for your talk. My question is your eSmart program,
yes.
And it's about changing our behaviours or staying clear of some of these destructive behaviours. What can you tell me a little bit more about some of the legislation that the foundation has been maybe, in line with, like, with governments and so forth?
Sure, yeah. The question of legislation is an interesting one because, and we talk about this a lot, because we certainly don't want to be a political lobbying organisation. That's not who we are. But having said that Brodie's Law, which is a Victorian law about workplace bullying, I mentioned before that foundation is now part of the Lana Madeline Foundation working closely with them. So we're looking to try and take that national. Where we do is we talk to governments about what the individual party's policies are in this area. In fact, the Liberals, 3 days before the election, actually quoted about cyber safety and wellbeing. They actually quoted the organisations they're going to work with, and we were one of them, which we're quite thrilled because we wanted influence through that way. But we're not in Canberra as lobbyists. We're not. What we try and do is raise with, frankly, whoever will listen. We do a lot with government because clearly they're the people who can, you know, they've got purse strings and they can influence about what the issues are and about how to cope with the issues and how to deal with the issues in the programs. In fact, that manifests itself in the Smart Schools program. How that initially got funded was actually federally. With a pilot funding to what is this thing called cyber safety, and that's how we were able to fund creating eSmart in the first place, and then the Victorian and Queensland governments are funding us to actually roll out, and that's why we can give it to a lot of schools for free, is because in this case, and that's us interacting with governments and the like to be able to say, hey, there's a real issue here, but it's very difficult because if you've got state jurisdictions, you've got federal jurisdictions, you'd all appreciate that. Working with the different education sectors. Again, we've got experts in this field who are dealing with this a lot. So we don't see ourselves as a lobby group, but we see ourselves being able to almost shout from the rooftops, there's a real issue here. Come on, governments, you know, we need to do something about it. And, okay, yeah, you can stand up and present it and the like, and we can do it together because it's not about ego. It's about, you know, making our children safer. But it's also a matter of then, in practical sense, governments are saying we've got no money and things like that, So that's why sometimes we talk federally, sometimes we talk state, sometimes we talk education, sometimes we talk technology. So we're not lobbyists, but we're certainly practical in that sense, and we're interacting with governments at all levels all the time.
Thank you for tonight. Mine's not so much a question, but I guess a comment, which is I think with the Buddy Bear program, I remember hearing about that a number of years ago, and
yep.
It's obviously been a stable and successful program if you've held on to it.
Better Buddies?
Better Buddies,
in the primary schools?
Yeah, the purple bear.
Yeah, that's right, the purple bear. That's right. That's Better Buddies. It's a big purple bear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just noticing that.
You've known about it?
I knew about the program and I recognised it.
Oh, fantastic. Okay.
So that must be successful if it's still around because I heard about it 2006, 2007.
Yes, indeed. Because we we've expanded that program, and thank you for that feedback. Because we've increased the number of schools since then, because we've been able to get some corporations to give us the money so we can give it to schools, which we love doing. And what we're hoping to do is, remember, if it starts off in a school with a prep student, they're going to be in that school for a whole lot of years. So we recognise that's a prevention program. So if we can change the schoolyard. And there's a big purple bear called Buddy Bear, and he teaches the children to be a buddy, not a bully. And so if we can influence children at that point in time, we won't see the results of that for a long, long time. And no one will ever relate Buddy Bear to a guy in a suit talking about the Alana Madeline Foundation. Doesn't need to, but if it changes that school, and I remember my own school, if I can just expand on that, my own school experiences from a generation ago, we would see bullying in the schoolyard, and we would accept that. Now we're saying that shouldn't be accepted. That shouldn't be the norm. That shouldn't be. So the population, the school population, all of us shouldn't accept that sort of form of intimidation and violence. So if we can create a culture of respect and caring from the bottom of the school, from a preppy to the grade fives and grade sixes, and as that prep goes through that school, in a few years' time, they'll be the grade sixer. So, and that grade sixer will then be into high school and then into the workplace. So that's why we take a long-term view. So I'm glad to hear that you've experienced it. And as we go along, we're now starting to see students that have been through and remember the purple bear. So it's good that he's getting out there. That's Buddy. And one thing I will never do is go in that suit because it's too heavy. And you think, like, you know, Humphrey Bear and things like that? Can you imagine putting one of those big suits on? That's one job I won't do in the foundation. It's too hard.
We're at a monastery in Geelong and we get a lot of parents and children coming. These are programs that are in the school, but I get a lot of parents and the kids are playing on the swings or running around the monastery and the parents are just tearing their hair out because they haven't got a clue about internet stuff.
Right.
And they're not being educated.
Yep, yep.
Their careers may know just the basic of community of things. So does your foundation, for instance, give us supplies to give a kit to the parents to say, this is what you can do about the computer, or can they do a course? Or
yeah.
Because you're hitting it from the kids, but
yes,
there's a lot of kids that are missed out.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, indeed. Which is why we're in schools, and these children are not being picked up in that, I get that.
Yeah, but we've got a lot of Greek kids who are going to all different schools.
Yeah, yeah, indeed.
So the parents, when the kids get home,
yep,
the parents haven't got a clue that kids can click out of something.
Yep. Yep.
And click into something. The parents haven't got a clue what the kids are looking at.
Yeah, indeed. Which is why I saw that the last of our programs were developed in schools, developed in libraries, workplaces starting to happen. And there's two things in the home which we're working on, which are pretty close, is e-smart homes. And by that is that's something that the parent and the family unit can look at together in terms of how do they set up the home? Where should the computer be in the home? Where, you know, should the child have 24/7 access to
the computer? How do you get the parents to know about e-smart homes if the kids want to hide about e-smart homes from the parents because they don't want to be limited?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. We're sneaky in the sense. You did right. And it's, look,
if you had the magic wand. There are quite a lot of kids that have been missed out on.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
We used to get a lot of kids that had come after the church service.
Mm.
Every Saturday, Sunday, we're packed with families. After the church service, the kids had come up to the bookshop, they'd go there, dive on the biscuits, and we'd have conversation with the kids.
Yes, yes.
They'd play on the swings, they'd go to the animals. Now, how many kids are there fiddling with these stupid games? And the parents have got used to the kids playing these games. Now, that is totally antisociable.
Yes, 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 indeed.
And I'd say to the kids, hey, Nicole, you used to talk to me.
Yep.
You're not talking to me anymore. I'm only allowed to play this on Sunday. And I'd turn around and to the parents, can you ban that when they come to the monastery not to play? Then you get the kids kicking up a stink because they don't want to come to the monastery.
Yeah, true.
So the parents are surrendering to the kids being allowed, or they've got a right to do that.
You do, yeah.
Other parents say, right, you've given me mouth, good. You got 1 week without your, I don't know even what they're called.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
Nintendo, whatever it is.
I think you've summarised very well.
Yeah. How can you help me? I'm not a school, but we got a lot of parents, a lot of kids. Help me have some sort of kit to give the parents, to educate the parents, because the kids are learning about it, but they're learning how to be sneaky behind the parents' backs.
I share your frustration and pain. And the other thing which I'd add to that is that, and I personally experience this, to be honest with you, and I'm lucky enough, born in this country, educated, and all that. My children know more about their technology. They can run rings around me. Even if I try, I don't know how to. No, that's not good at all. So our approach is through education, and it's there's no magic wand. But what we're trying to do is, you'll notice that kids go to school. We try and catch them there. Libraries, get them there. But the most importantly, what's coming, and you're absolutely, I think you should come work for us. Because you've all this strategy stuff I'm talking about, and how we build our programs is by these sorts of conversations, because we identify a need. And what we recognise is, how do you help you need something in the home environment, and you need, so that's something the parent can look at and say, well, how do I cope with this? Where do I turn to find out about this? Yeah, we empower the parents, educate. So that's where the smart, safe and responsible comes in, is how do we empower and educate them? And where do they turn? And next month, next year, it'll be a different piece of technology. So that's why we're working. We've recognised schools is up and running. We've got libraries up and running. We're working on the home environment now. And the other piece in that is the digital licence. By that, I mean it's the equivalent of a swimming or pen licence in a school and the like. So it's a tool that the parent will be able to say, well, if you want to go and be able to take your mobile phone to the monastery, you have to show to me that you've got your digital licence, which means there's a level of education in that child. So it's not something we can solve overnight, but the way we go about articulating our programs is the conversation we're just having here is exactly the sort of conversation we'd have, and that's why you would have seen a couple. I'm not sure. Come and have a coffee with me one day. Indeed. So, but I think that it demonstrates that it's not something that you can solve overnight, and the technology changes. If we were having this conversation a number of years ago, we wouldn't have even been talking about some of the language. There's words that are coming into language, and that'll continue to be. That's why our approach is through education. One of the most challenging things is the multicultural nature of Australia and the nuances of our different cultures. I'm lucky enough to be always, given my background, to be always piping up and saying, well, what about the ethnicity of this? Because it's all right to do this in English and stuff like that. I know we've got brochures in 8 different languages, and we had to get someone to help us. You know, that costs money. We had to get someone we actually got someone who thought that was a great idea, so they paid for us to do all that sort of stuff. But, you know, so I understand and share your issue. We're aware of it and we've got some things in place. The analogy I've used internally because of my heritage, I suppose, is the power imbalance between the parent and the child. And what I recounted was the power imbalance, because I used to see a lot of families when I was in Richmond where the children could speak English and the parents couldn't, and the parents were reliant on the child to be able to interact and communicate. And there was a power shift. I noticed that, and I've used that analogy internally in our organisation because I see it now. I love my child, I want to protect my child, but I don't know, you don't just ban them. And that's why eSmart Homes will talk about where is the technology in the house. We've often talked about clunky language, but a social contract. All right, if you come home, you have a break after school, you do your homework, and between this time and this time, you can be engaged in technology. And in our case, what we've done is it's technology gets checked. There's no technology in the bedroom. So after this time of night, my children cannot have their technology in there. But it's a dialogue and negotiation rather than me. The generations have changed. I cannot be that authority figure. It's a generational change. That, if my father said something, I'd jump. Now, I don't know what happened, but I don't have that same. But it's now a social contract, we're calling it. But what you've articulated is an issue which we continue to grapple with. But we have got some steps. We're taking some tiny steps in that direction, but we're certainly aware of it. So thank you for the question.
I just wanted to ask, is it part of school curriculum to involve the teachers with the children in education about what behaviour is appropriate and what behaviour is not appropriate as part of the learning program in school, like maths and English? They have like a social subject?
Yeah, I'll preface my comments by saying I'm not an education expert, but there is a thing called the National Safe Schools Framework. And so it's a framework for exactly that. I'll say this as an observer rather than my official capacity, is that governments can do stuff and they can write it down, but they've got to understand the practical reality of what happens in a school and what happens in a family and what happens in the school, in the playground and the like. It's all right to put a lovely brochure, a lovely book out and things like that, but it's actually trying to embed it in the culture. That's why we use things like a big purple bear rather than just do it by memo, which no one's going to listen to. We try and show behaviour change and things like that. So there are parts of the curricula which are National Safe School Framework certainly is part of that. And look, the day and age, it's such a big issue in society. People are recognising that. And so we deal a lot with education departments and things about, well, what should that actually look like in the school? So we're able to interact with them. And they do listen to us a bit. So there's a long way to go, but I think it's starting to improve a bit.
This is to support what you're saying. There is a lot of literature, a lot of data on schools that have looked at anti-bullying, and they've come up with great brochures or great documents and reports. But when observers have gone in to do some real hardcore research, they have seen a lot of bullying in the school ground. And you're right, it is about culture, it is about the parents. There's a lot of work to do. So your job is big.
Yeah, it is big, but we don't shy away from that. And we appreciate it's a multiple approach. It's the school, it's the library, it's the home, it's everywhere. And the like, and we try and get to the practical reality of it as much as we can. A lot of it is about raising awareness of the issue, because I don't think it's just us because we work in this space. I've noticed a lot more about bullying. In fact, a lot of people will cite it's a bully. I was bullied, and things like that. I've seen a lot more dialogue in general press and the like about bullying as a topic. And I think that's a good thing, because if we're talking about the issue, we're raising the issue, everyone will start to recognise it as an issue, and governments will support it and the like. I think the advantage an organisation like ours has is we are a charity, we're not for profit, we're not political, so we're free of that. We do have strong education links, we do understand how governments work, but we're also an organisation that has to be self-funding and has to get results, otherwise we wouldn't exist, people wouldn't support us anymore. So we have to think quite entrepreneurially as well. So we have to find things that work, otherwise we won't survive and won't exist and people won't support us anymore. So it's not just a matter of we've got an amount of money, we spend it, doesn't matter what happens next. We are like a small business in many ways. My goodness, it has to work, otherwise we won't exist tomorrow. So that keeps us on our toes and keeps us quite nimble in that sense. And governments have recognised that we can do, the third sector, not-for-profit and charity sector, can do things that governments can't do. Because when you think about it, it's kind of interesting. An organisation like the Alana Madeline Foundation, which is, you know, I say it's quite big. It has 50 people in it. It had 8 people in it 7 or 8 years ago. Can create something called eSmart, which governments turn around and say, oh, well, you've come up with that with all the resources of government, and they get us to roll it out for them. And that's just because we think differently to what government does, but we're sort of positioned across all sectors, so we're not competing with anybody. And it's a big task, but we don't shy away from it, and we'll continue to shout from the rooftops to do something about it.
Just wondering maybe if you could expand on valuing difference, but in particular, given the changing makeup of our society, some of the challenges that presents and how perhaps you reconcile that the valuing of the difference with obviously promoting various cultural norms and values in a way through what you do.
I think the first thing is to state it and acknowledge it for ourselves and continue to think about it. It's steps we've taken. We've got a long way to go in that sense, but even the nature of how we look at an issue, I've given you a particular lens tonight, which is very much just one look at how an organisation like this exists. If we had our senior researcher from the cyber safety, they would give you a completely different presentation tonight, because they would be coming from the latest research point of view and the like. So the difference in our lens at the moment is mainly through the way we bring different views of the issue together to try and get an outcome. It's quite deliberate that we're all together, and I'm pointing because we're located just across the road. So when we talk about an issue and the sort of things we've talked about tonight, we get people, you know, in the room will be someone with me with a pragmatic business background. We'll have a researcher who basically doesn't like people like me because I look like this and I represent accountants or whatever. But they'll be talking about what the technology view is. We'll have someone we have people who actually school teachers, because don't ask me how a school operates because I've never actually worked in one, but we've got people who can. So when we design a program for a school, we've got people who worked in libraries, so we're designing a program for that. So in many ways, it's value and difference at a very simple level like that. Even the way our workforce is structured in terms of work-life balance is not just lip service, it's genuine, it's real. In that sense. So I think by starting by us trying to state that and make sure we're aware of it in terms of who our volunteers are, the organisations we interact with, the organisations we deal with and the like. So we've got a long way to go, as I think society does, but it's something we're quite happy to take risks and with people in terms of giving them a go. We're quite happy in terms of, you know, if we fail but we had a go at something, well, that's part of who we are and what we're about. So it's a very supportive and compassionate environment like that. It recognises the fact that I can be an employee, but I can also, most importantly, be a human being and a dad. So, you know, and those sorts of things. So it's very different to other workplaces I've been involved in the sense if something's going on at home, frankly, it's more important than the next meeting I have to go to, and we recognise that, and that's fine. So we've got a long way to go, and there's small steps, but the very fact that we're recognising is value difference rather than accepting, you know, I think, you know, significant for us, but we recognise there's a long, long way to go. Thank you for the question. Now, someone's got to ask me about how I went in the marathon yesterday and how hard it was and how long it took me and how come I'm still standing up. What was the time? I finished on Sunday. You know, it took me 4 hours and 31 minutes. All right. So by the time I finished, the winners had been home, had a full lunch, had probably read the newspaper, watched a couple of movies. And my wife also ran it yesterday. And I'm delighted to say my children actually ran the half marathon too. So we're honouring our Greek heritage there with the marathon. It's an important obsession that we have. Well, thank you for your attention. I do appreciate it and for giving me this opportunity. I'd particularly like to acknowledge and thank Father Chris for allowing me this opportunity. So thank you very much.
Through the prayers of our holy fathers, Lord Jesus Christ, our God, have mercy on us and save us. Amen. May God bless you all and keep you well.